Before we start this episode of CFD's Podcast for Good, let's give a little shout out to our presenting sponsor, WSECU. WSECU has been a part of the community since 1957 and has been supporting the CFD in a big way since 2011. Thanks to them, we were able to bring you spectacular events and promotions like the Masquerade Ball, Golf for Veterans Tournament, and our incredible First Week to Give, which has been responsible for raising tens of thousands of dollars in donations to charities throughout our community. For more on how WSECU serves charities throughout our community, visit www.wsecu.org/community. And of course, visit our website to find out more about our incredible partnership with WSECU. And now, here's the show.
This is the weirdest place we've ever done this.
I know, right? So,
Hi, we're reporting from a dark room somewhere in the bowels of L&I.
Ka, 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 ka. I also like that the lights are dim.
I know.
Yeah.
This is really, it's weird. This is strange. And not dim in like a good way. Dim in like a weird lighted way.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
This is not like a fun thing.
Also, at some point, I feel like someone will be like, excuse me?
You can't be in a room with all that fancy equipment.
Did you approve this through the union?
Yeah.
Sorry, we did not.
Nope. Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Season 2, Episode 5 of CFD's Podcasts for Good. We are rolling on with World Water Month.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is, I'm totally jealous that you got to record these people without me being there.
I had a great time.
Yeah. I'm Philip Carrigan. I'm the program manager of the Washington State Combined Fund Drive. And this is, as always,
Heather Lucas, the fiscal and policy coordinator for the Combined Fund Drive.
Yeah. So we're talking World Water Month. So we talk to organizations that deal with water. This was a topic I specifically asked you to put on the on the episodes.
And then you got to do all
the interviews.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
Well, maybe we'll do water again in the future and make sure that if it comes up where you've got to be out for trainings or all the multitude of events, we'll make it happen.
Okay, cool.
You're there.
Because for me, I feel like this is a huge issue.
Dude, it so is.
It's really big. Yeah. And like, maybe it's because it's so simple, like it's water.
Yeah.
And it comes out of all faucets and showerheads for us that we don't like think about it.
Yeah.
But there are like literal cities that are running out of water.
Running out
like
of water.
Like, that's insanity.
Yeah. And not only running out of water, but they don't have access to just simple, clean water.
Yeah.
And they have to go so far to get dirty water.
Right. Yeah. This is like one of those, like, it's like food.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a big deal.
It's a basic need.
Yeah. And we don't, like, we don't see it very often, but that's why I think people were so shocked by places like Flint.
Yeah.
Where, like, it was almost like people went like, wait, what? Yeah. People have problems with their water in this country?
How is that happening?
Yeah, and then you see all these investigative reports that talk about, like, Flint is just the tip of the iceberg. It could get worse and worse and worse.
Yeah.
So I think it's even going to be an issue for people in this country at some point.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you talk about infrastructure,
we're
talking, like, water pipes, main like, actual places, factories.
I know.
And the places where water funnels through and gets clean. But, like, when you talk about infrastructure, the thing that's mostly reported is what? Bridges and roads.
Yeah, that's right.
That's all we hear about.
I mean, we're not talking about the lead pipes that have been underground for years and years and years, or copper piping or all this stuff.
Yeah, exactly. I live in Shelton, and probably 3 years ago, they started replacing the pipes that had been embedded for like 50 to 70 years.
There's definitely things happening with those.
Yeah.
But we're specifically, this one, you sat down with two charities that deal more in the international
community,
where it is actually probably even more of an emergency situation.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, shockingly, one of the other reasons why I think this topic always is compelling is because when you hear about, like, the pricing points associated with what it takes to build a well in a village, it's like nothing.
Yeah.
Like, in Africa, you could be like $100,
and
it buys like a whole well,
That will sustain itself for 30 years.
That's the other thing, because people are always asking, like, well, I don't have a lot. What sort of impact can I make with smaller donations? Mm-hmm. Water in international developing countries, the concept of bringing clean water to those places is actually not as expensive as people think.
Exactly.
And so that's why I think this is another cool one.
Well, yeah, when I was talking with Friendly Water for the World, I mean, they have technologies that they implement. The biosand filter
is one of those things. Which is a pretty neat little trick,
by the way. It is super neat, yeah. And David Albert, the board chairman who I talked to, he had said that one of these Biosand filters lasts 30 years.
That's crazy talk.
So that's 30 years of water that could actually provide life.
Yeah.
You know, simple
literal
life for so many people throughout that whole time.
Yeah, that's crazy to me.
Yeah.
And it's they're all like really like there's these very cool inexpensive ways of being able to do it. The raw materials are cheaper in places like that are in Africa and South America, so you can build these things a little bit easier.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's another reason why. You sat down with, as you said, David Albert. He's the board chairman of Friendly Water for the World.
Yeah.
And for the record, for those listening, he's a former state employee as
well.
Yes,
we did mention that.
Yeah, and then Living Water International, the development director for the West.
Yes.
Not for the East or Central.
Nope,
for West. The West.
It's very specific.
Jeff Chase.
Yes.
Yes, so you sat down with both of them and talked a little bit about it. What, in your opinion, were some of the things you got out of the interview that you didn't know before?
That I didn't know before? I would say that the things that I didn't know before was about how if you have dirty water, whatever kind of sustenance that you get from food, like your food is supposed to be energizing you. Food is fuel, right?
Yeah.
So if your water is dirty and there are bacteria in it, your fuel is now fighting the bacteria instead of fueling you.
Wow.
Yeah. So it never occurred to me. Like, this is a correlation between the two.
Yeah.
It never occurred to
me. That's crazy, too. Yeah. So it doesn't matter how well you eat.
Yeah.
If you have bad water, that food's not going to make you grow or anything.
No, exactly.
It's going
to attack your growth will be stunted, especially if you're a child, because you have to have food to grow.
Yeah.
But if the water is dirty, that's bad. And the bacteria inside will fight you.
That's crazy.
So the food goes to help fight the bacteria.
Right.
And the same thing, this is something I talked with David about, also for anybody who has a disease.
Mm-hmm.
So people who have HIV, if they're taking HIV drugs that fight it with dirty water, it's the same thing.
Oh my gosh, you're kidding me.
So the HIV drugs aren't as helpful, so people die more and quickly.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
It's so insane to me how water is like the central definer for everything.
Yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah.
Those are two really good ones.
Yeah. That was kind of mind-blowing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The HIV medication doesn't work as well if you're drinking dirty water.
Yeah. And I can imagine it'd be the same thing if it was cholera.
Yeah.
If it was
any antibiotic.
Flu.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
wow.
Any kind of a cough.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not going away
yeah.
if you're drinking dirty water.
Yeah. So I think I find this stuff really interesting, and I think we might get into it a little bit with the statistics. I think my impression is that through the efforts of places like Living Water International and Friendly Water for the World and Water.org and Charity Water, that you are seeing more access to water in those developing countries. But I still don't think it's enough.
I don't think it's enough either. And I do think that it is something where these organizations are bringing this more to light.
Yeah.
So it's more talked about.
Yeah.
But is it enough?
No. I mean, you think about it, too. Like, we talk about... How do systems change? How does poverty change?
Yeah.
And you talk about the root cause of some of those sort of things.
Yeah.
Education, job placements, those sort of things. I mean, this is literally like patient zero.
Yeah, education and poverty, water is patient zero, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, water is
Absolutely.
Patient zero.
Yeah.
Like, you got to have water.
Yeah, and if you don't, then you're
then
not
none
able
of that
to
other,
move
then
on.
None of that other stuff matters.
You can't grow
this
through
is,
life.
See, this is what I'm saying. We hit
we're
it
gonna
with
have
this
to, We're going to have to do another water
Can't
one.
Believe you.
Just
got
for
to,
you.
Yeah, I know. Dang it.
Not for the charities themselves, just for you.
I know. And if we can get Matt Damon on the show.
Okay.
Because he does water.org, I'd appreciate you pulling some strings and getting Matt Damon on.
Oh, I got you. Yeah.
I don't need Affleck anymore. I can do
Damon and Krasinski?
Yes. Have Krasinski come on.
I like that.
Okay, so before we move into interviews, hit me with the question of the pod.
Well, we are talking about water.
Yes.
So it's summertime and water. They go hand in hand. So what is, in your opinion, the best place to spend the day on the water in Washington State?
Okay. So I'm going to go two categories.
Yeah.
Man-made and natural.
Okay.
Okay. So natural, I would say like along the Columbia River. Certain pieces of the Columbia are pretty cool.
Nice.
Also, if you go in a specific portions of the Columbia River, like your scenery is also
insane. Yeah.
So I would say, like, you know, like the southeastern portion of the Columbia River.
Okay.
Pretty cool.
Okay.
man-made. We just went to it like 2 weeks ago. Silverwood. Although that's not in Washington State.
No, it's not technically. No. I mean, it's like Wild Waves.
I would say Wild Waves, but Silverwood blows Wild Waves out of the water.
See, I've not been. I've not been, so.
It's insane.
Yeah.
It's got the tidal wave pools. It's got huge, like, water slides. It's super.
I've heard getting the cabanas is the way to go, too. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, there were a million people there. So we got like an inch of grass for the five of us.
Nice.
But, you know, overall, that's what I would go. Nice. So Silverwood, even though it's not in Washington State, it's close.
It is
I think
close.
It's close enough.
I'll accept that
Thank
answer.
You. I appreciate you accepting that. And then the Columbia River. Nice. What about you?
I've spent quite a bit of time on the Skokomish River.
Ah.
Yeah, it is quite lovely.
I love that name, the Skokomish.
Yeah, exactly. And it's in my neighborhood, so I've got some friends who have gone out there and...
Tubing down it? Or, like, floating down it in a
just
tube?
Just hanging out.
See, that's amazing.
Yeah, just hanging out in the water.
Have a little beer or soda.
Yeah. Yeah, soda, quote unquote.
Soda, have a little soda for the PG folks. Yeah. Have a little soda.
Because we don't drink alcohol.
We don't drink alcohol
no,
here.
Ever.
So we've been informed by our marketing development person to continue keeping this portion of the segment in. We're going to pose this question to you on Twitter. What is your favorite place to spend the day on the water in Washington State? We're at WaStateCFD.
Yeah.
Hit us up. Tell us yours. Not a single one of you have answered this question yet. But Jerrica told us to keep it in, so we're going to keep it in.
You know, if you just keep going...
Eventually, your own stubbornness will lead to success.
It's true.
That's been my experience.
I like it.
So we're going to toss it to the first interview, which is Friendly Water for the World and the board chairman, David Albert.
So I'm here with David Albert, the board chairman of Friendly Water for the World. David, thank you for joining me today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yes. Can you give us a little history about Friendly Water for the World and what your organization does for the community?
Well, sure. Friendly Water for the World is based in Olympia. In fact, we are Olympia's own international non-governmental organization.
Nice.
And we were founded in 2010, although we have a prehistory that goes to 2006. And we teach people all around the world simple ways to clean their own drinking water.
Okay.
Without moving parts, without electricity, without chemicals, all made of natural, locally available materials. We don't do it for people. We teach people to do it themselves.
Okay.
And we're in 15 countries, everywhere from India and Afghanistan all the way over to Mexico and Guatemala. We plan to be in Bolivia later this year.
Okay.
Most of our work, however, is in East and Central Africa.
Okay. So safe drinking water and sanitation, they're often talked about hand in hand. So how does one of those affect the other when it comes to people living in areas where there's water scarcity?
Sure. Well, there are about 2 billion people on Earth that do not have regular access to clean drinking water.
Okay.
And the impact on families and communities, especially in rural areas or underserved communities, is devastating.
Yeah.
Child mortality remains high. Almost as bad as that is children between the ages of 1 and 5 suffer from something called parasitic stress.
Okay.
The food that should be feeding their brains, working toward cognitive development, is going into fighting off parasites. So you get children that are stunted. In India, as many as 20% of all children are stunted. It's called the largest brain drain in the history of the world.
So the food itself, the nutrients in the food, that's supposed to, of course, make everybody grow and live. And
right, but instead it's fighting off waterborne illnesses, waterborne parasites.
Wow.
It means if the kids ever get to school, they can't learn.
Yeah.
So investments in education go to waste. Families can't plan because they have sick children.
Yeah.
They have sick adults. Community productivity is reduced. Now, you asked about the relationship between water and sanitation.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, our main work is in public health, in making water safe. However, we also teach people to build rainwater catchment systems, which in some ways will obviate the long walk for water.
Okay.
If you can capture your rain right near your home or your school, you don't have to go walk 5.5 kilometers each way to get water from a swamp, which is often the case in the places we work. We also teach people to build what are called micro-flush toilets.
Okay.
These are a very simple toilet. It's a composting toilet, but it uses worms.
Oh, really?
You're right. It's really kind of a neat thing. And it means you don't have to muck them out for two and a half years, and they don't smell.
Because the worms are taking care of all
the
business.
The worms do all the work.
Nice.
So we do that as well. We also teach people to make what we call friendly soap.
Okay.
It's a soap that doesn't use palm oil. There's a big problem with people cutting palm trees, especially in India and Africa, to make soap.
Okay.
And we've teach people to make a liquid soap without having to cut palm trees.
Nice. So sanitation would be more about toilets, soap, things
washing
like
that. Washing your hands.
Keeping these things clean so you don't actually end up getting any of the foodborne or waterborne illnesses into your body.
Correct. But without the clean water, all of that goes to waste.
So you'd mentioned that sometimes people travel 5 kilometers to get to water.
Right.
Is there like an average that you know about, like how far people have to travel?
It's going to vary from place to place. Mm-hmm. But in many places, for example, they will take children out of school.
Really?
To do the water walk twice a day, as long as 5.5 kilometers each way. We've seen that everywhere from India to Uganda.
So water is more of an important thing to get nailed down and taken care of to build those other blocks like education.
Water is the basis of everything. Mm-hmm. Without clean water, because people are not healthy, you can't do much of anything. If you have clean water, as we say, everything is possible.
Nice. I like that. That's a good phrase. So I saw on your website, and I've met you before, and we've talked a little bit about what you do, but biosand filters, how do those work?
So biosand filters were invented by Dr. David Manns at the University of Calgary in 1993. He'd worked on them for 14 years.
Mm-hmm.
He patented the technology and gave the patent to the world.
Nice.
The technology was based on something invented by the Egyptians 4,000 years ago. It's called a slow sand filter.
Okay.
But basically what he did was he managed to engineer a box. You could think of it as a cement box, 3 feet high, 1 foot square,
mm-hmm.
with carefully prepared and layered gravel and sand.
Okay.
We have figured out the scientific needs for the size of the sand, how clean it has to be, and what have you. And it can remove up to 99% of bacteria, 100% of disease-causing viruses, worms, protozoa, and amoeba, and it works for 30 years with virtually no maintenance.
Seriously, so it's sand, layers of different types of sand.
Now, your municipal water system
uses
sand filtration as well. It has a chemical layer, usually a chemical additive at the bottom.
Yeah.
With biosand filters, we use the natural action of a pond, essentially, at the top, where there's standing water, which is filled with all kinds of disease-causing organisms. But when you pour new water in, they cannibalize each other. And you kill about 80% of your large disease-causing organisms right in the first 2 inches of water.
Wow. That is impressive. So biosand filters are something that Friendly Water for the World goes and... Do you install them? Do you show people how to build them?
We have a 5-day training program. We teach people how to make them, how to distribute them, how to sell them, mm-hmm. how to install them, and how to maintain them. Raw materials for biosand filters will vary in cost, but generally between $12 and $26.
Okay.
Average is about $17. Everyone involved in our projects gets paid.
Yeah.
There are transportation costs and follow-up.
Sure.
And we want every project to make a profit.
Sure,
because then people start reinvesting back into their communities.
And then they reinvest in water and keeping it clean.
Correct.
So as far as the biosand filters go, how many do you think your organization has helped construct and get out there into the world?
We are in more than 170 communities.
Okay.
We think the number is somewhat above 45,000 of them, providing water to more than 500,000 people.
Nice. Very awesome.
And we're based right here in Olympia, Washington.
Yeah, see, just little Olympia, doing what we can, right? So, of course, we've seen, like, in news from time to time, it comes up, like, Cape Town was a big thing recently,
right.
where it was like, there is a water shortage.
Right.
So as far as, like, a large city or a large community, like, it's not, I don't think it's too common to think this major city has a water shortage and a water crisis. Could something like a biosand filter or a system like that really make a difference for them?
With one exception, we actually do not work in large municipal areas.
Sure.
we think really what's needed there are good municipal water systems.
Makes sense.
And people have to pressure their governments to get them.
Yeah.
Most of our work is in very rural areas
yeah.
with the most marginalized and oppressed people.
Mm-hmm.
We work with widows, people with HIV, mm-hmm. people with albinism, victims, actually survivors of rape and sexual assault in wartime,
mm-hmm.
Tribal populations, orphans,
yeah.
unemployed youth, gender and sexual minorities. We really work with the most marginalized and oppressed people in all of these communities, and we turn them into community heroes.
Nice. And as far as you had mentioned Mexico, so that's this side of the mm-hmm. hemisphere, but a lot of focus seems to be Africa because it is a massive area.
Well, in Mexico, after the earthquake, you know, you've all heard of the Mexico City earthquake,
yeah.
but it wasn't a Mexico City earthquake.
It was based more rural,
in,
right?
Well, it was actually based in Puebla.
Okay. Or,
and there are indigenous communities south of Puebla.
Yeah.
And they lost access to their clean water supply.
So whatever kind of pipes and systems they
right,
had already built
gone,
in, gone.
And they're not going to be repaired, I'll bet, for 2 decades.
Yeah.
So we had a group of folks went to, worked out of Puebla,
mm-hmm.
but trained 3 indigenous communities to start building biosand water filters, and they're doing great.
Nice.
We also work with a group called Flying Doctors of Mercy. This is
okay.
a group out of San Diego that started doctors flying to Sinaloa, Mexico, to provide medical care on weekends. And they've been doing this since 1934.
Nice.
But they noticed that roughly 80% of the conditions they deal with are waterborne illnesses.
Ah.
So they came to us and said, you know, we probably don't have to provide half this treatment if people could figure out how to have clean water in their communities.
So start with the clean water.
So we've started doing training with the people around Sinaloa.
Nice. And then you had mentioned, like, we talked a little about the earthquake, but is that something where you see more and more natural disasters need to have their water really checked and then have something like biosand filters come in, people who can get water, clean water, and access back out?
The worst thing we've seen is global climate change.
Yeah.
My best example is in central Tanzania among
okay.
the Maasai people. Maasai are generally herders of cows, goats, whatever.
Okay.
And because of climate change, their herds have been depleted, and they're setting up little makeshift villages.
Okay.
In places where there's essentially no water.
Okay.
Or little water.
So they're leaving where they are
right.
naturally
and,
from?
And there's certainly no clean water.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been training Maasai women to build biosand water filters.
Okay.
They're using that money that they're earning.
Mm-hmm.
They're putting it in a collective pot to build cisterns and rainwater catchment systems so they don't have to travel so far for water. And this is happening in mostly in central Tanzania. But we're seeing the same thing in central Uganda.
Yeah.
We're seeing it in the Congo and in India. The
yeah.
water table in India, all over India, is dropping rapidly.
Wow. Do you find that the water catchment systems are something that's really making a big impact?
They can.
Yeah.
We're working with 370 families in Mwanza in northern Tanzania, all of whom are impacted by HIV.
Okay.
Including 42 families that lived on a little mountainside.
Mm-hmm.
And they were getting sicker and sicker. They took their children out of school, and they'd have to buy water at the bottom of the hill.
Okay.
And then they'd have to pay somebody to carry the water up the hill.
Yeah.
And then the water made them sick.
So that's
opportunistic infections
yeah.
would attack them. So the first thing we did is helped another community build 42 biosand filters for them.
Okay.
They got healthy within 5 weeks.
Nice.
Next thing is we trained the people at the Uzima Center in Mwanza to go into business selling biosand water filters. They've sold more than 1,000 of them.
Very
and
nice.
It employed all these formerly entirely unemployed people with HIV. Last week, we trained 2 groups to build rainwater catchment systems.
Okay.
And they built one of 20,000 liters right on top of the hill.
Nice. Now we're
going
back down
and
that hill.
Wait a minute. I got photos this morning. It rained last night.
Yeah.
And there are school children coming to get water. An interesting thing happened. The local government loved the project.
Okay.
And so they told the participants, you come back the next day. They didn't tell them why. There was a surprise party.
Yeah.
They brought school children to do skits on what it had been like to have to go walking for water. They had songs, dance. Local officials came, and then they presented the local group with $500.
Yeah.
They said, we're buying all the water in the first from the first fill-up of the 20,000 liters to present the water to the community.
Nice. That's super rad.
Mm. 2 days ago.
2 days ago. You guys work more in rural areas, but I was reading about the UN has Millennium Development Goals.
Yes.
Goal 6, it says clean water and sanitation, something they're going to work for. So, in your experience, do you think that organizations like the UN or larger governments are doing enough for clean water in their communities?
Not even close.
Yeah.
As I said, there are 2 billion people on the planet without regular access to clean water. The measure, where water has improved very significantly in the last 20 years is in China.
Okay.
And in some of the wealthier countries in South America.
Okay.
But in many countries like India and Central and East Africa, if anything, it's gotten worse.
Well, and India is a massive country with so many people.
Right. And 48% of the people don't have regular access to clean water.
It's madness.
Right. So the measurement systems for the Millennial Goals, I have to tell you, are somewhat suspect as well.
Yeah.
The World Health Organization measures what are called improved water sources. They don't measure clean water. They measure improved water sources, and the improved water source is defined as water coming through a pipe.
That's it.
It doesn't have to be clean going in.
Ah.
It does not have to be clean going out.
Wow.
As more people move to cities, they're getting more piped water, but the water is not clean.
So it doesn't really matter if the water's coming through a pipe or not.
There's not a single city in India where the water is safe to drink.
Really?
In New Delhi, after the water is treated, certain areas of New Delhi have 10,000 times the E. coli count that's recommended by health officials.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So they're not really...
But it's all an improved water source, according to the World Health Organization.
So then, if it's an improved water source, it's kind of like knocked off. We don't need to look at that anymore, right?
Well, the governments know that they're measured by the Millennial Development Goals, and the way they measure it is by improved water sources.
And that's just the standard, so they don't have to do anything more to make it safe or healthy.
Well, they do have to, but they don't.
Yikes. So let's say someone hears this podcast, and they want to start giving to Friendly Water for the World.
Sure. That's great. You can find us at www.friendlywater.net.
Mm-hmm.
We also have many events around town. Again, we are Olympia-based.
Yeah.
Actually, this weekend we're holding two events, Ethiopian dinners and lunches. Our Ethiopian rep is not a very good public speaker, but he's a fabulous cook.
That matters. Food matters.
We have a regular training program in August this year. It's at August 18th to 22nd, where we spend 5 days training people here just as if we were training in Africa.
Very nice. Many
of the people who attend those trainings, they may be part of a mission group at their church, or they may be part a Peace Corps alumni.
Okay.
Or Peace Corps people we train, and they will go abroad and use the technology. Some people just come because they really want to be part of the experience.
Yeah.
But we have events all year round, and you can find out what we're up to at www.friendlywater.net. You can also find us on Facebook at Friendly Water for the World.
And then for Friendly Water for the World, I mean, August is World Water Month.
Right.
So do you find that you have more events and more hype and more publicity and more access during this month? Or?
Well, we sure have a lot of events, I can tell you, between our Ethiopian lunch and dinner and our training program coming up. And then in September, we're having our signature event, Friendly Water Fest, on September 8th at the Olympia Friends Meeting House on Boston Harbor Road. We're having a very kid-friendly event with African music, dancers, dance showcases, water games, food, sand sculptures, face painting. The local fire truck is coming.
Nice.
And it's our signature event. It's called Friendly Water Fest. September 8th, 12 to 4. And again, you can find it at our website at www.friendlywater.net.
And then last question I want to ask, can you talk about what donations from donors like CFD donors do for your organization?
Donations from people like you make our work possible.
Yeah.
Let me give you an idea. $5 a month, just $5 a month, $2.50 per pay period. I used to work for the state.
Yeah, so you know how it works.
$2.50 per pay period can provide a biosand filter for a school or an orphanage with 70 kids that'll provide clean water for the next 30 years. $2.50 a month for 1 year.
For 1 year.
For 1 year. We'll provide water for 70 kids for the next 30 years.
And that could impact probably millions of kids down the line 30
years. It sure can. And we are very, very careful with our use of money. We're part of a movement called the Effective Altruism Movement.
Okay.
And the idea of effective altruism is to prove that you don't really need a lot of money to make effective change. You need to target it well and intelligently, mm-hmm. and then evaluate, making sure that what you do makes a real difference. So we make it a point to show donors precisely what their money is doing.
Sure.
Precisely where it went, and then we evaluate it, and when things don't work, we'll tell them.
Yeah.
We think that's important.
They need to hear failures and successes,
they
right?
need to hear everything.
Yeah.
We call ourselves an action research organization. You know, we're very small. Our budget last year was only $475,000 in the U.S. But we have found that for every dollar we put in the field, the mm-hmm. return to local communities is between $10 and $14.
Wow. So it is a serious turnover there.
It's a very serious turnover. And we're able to do that because we have learned to target well. I have to tell you, too, that our country, we have country representatives in these countries. They're all local.
Okay.
They do all the work. In some sense, we are their servants.
Yeah.
Because they're the folks who really make things work on the ground.
And they're like essentially public servants for the community, right?
Right. Correct. Nice. And then we have communities. I talked about people with HIV earlier. I want to follow up on that a little bit. So studies done, most of these studies were done in southwest Kenya.
Okay.
They discovered that with just clean water, no antiretroviral drugs, mm-hmm. a person with HIV will likely live 5 to 8 years longer. The impact of that, if you have a young child, is tremendous.
Yeah.
If you die when the child is 2 or 3, they're going to go into one of these really awful orphanages.
Sure.
If you live until they're 10 or 11, they're likely to be taken in by another family member.
Very
That's
nice.
Number one.
Yeah.
Number two, if you have regular access to clean water and antiretroviral drugs, you can live indefinitely, like here.
Yeah.
And antiretroviral drugs are now most places relatively easy to obtain in most developing countries. So you could live indefinitely that way. But the other thing, however, mm-hmm. is that if you have access to antiretroviral drugs but you don't have clean water to take them with, their effectiveness is cut down by as much as 80% because opportunistic infections attack.
Like the food.
Right. So what we have done in many communities, our Uganda representative is president of his Rotary Club, member of his district water committee, has a degree in environmental management. He wants you to know that he has HIV.
Okay.
And he heads a program of ours called Building New Lives. You see, we know from experience that we can take a community with HIV, mm-hmm. many of whom have basically given up hope. They've taken their kids out of school because they're no longer strong enough to go gather water.
Sure.
Essentially fixing to die. They've given up their occupations. And all of a sudden, we've got them healthy. So the question is, what happens next?
Yeah.
We train them in all forms of water technology.
Okay.
We train them to build and sell biosand filters. We train them in friendly soap. We train them in rainwater catchment. We train them to repair simple repairs on pumps and boreholes. And they go out into the community and can earn a living while safeguarding the water of their communities.
So they become a productive member of society.
Not only productive, they become community leaders.
Ah, so even more than they would have been just having clean out.
And we have Building New Lives projects in 5 countries.
Okay, what countries are they?
Congo, Uganda, Kenya, Tanzania, and Rwanda.
Very nice. You had mentioned the events on September 8th, and then was there any other upcoming event for the remainder of the year?
Well, we make a big deal about Giving Tuesday.
Ah, yeah, Giving Tuesday is in November.
It's an opportunity for people to give back.
Yeah.
To remember that there's more to the spirit of the holidays than simply local or family gift giving. Our campaign this year is going to be built around children.
Okay.
Children and friendly water for the world. We work with children in these 15 countries. Mm-hmm. And specifically, we're working with people with albinism in Tanzania. Okay. Albinism is a skin condition where the skin, there's no melanin.
The skin is white.
Pigments mm-hmm. are white. And these folks are heavily discriminated against.
Okay.
And the result of that, they live on reservations like native reservations here, but much poorer than those. And we have now been teaching them to build biosand filters. Actually, we're going to start later in August to teach them to build rainwater catchment systems. And I have to tell you, I'm headed over there in October, and I've brought eyeglasses. Many people with albinism have very, very poor eyesight, and the kids can't see the board, and they can't see books.
Okay, so you have eyeglasses that
So I've managed to buy 1,000 pair of eyeglasses. Nice. They cost me 12 cents a piece.
Oh, wow.
I have a source. So a lot of our work is going to be with children with albinism in Tanzania.
Okay, right on.
And we'd love to have you donate to that. You can find us at www.friendlywater.net.
Very nice. Well, David, thank you very much for coming on the podcast and telling us about Friendly Water for the World.
Thank you.
All right, so that was David Albert from Friendly Water for the World. He talked a little bit about what his organization does in developing countries. We're going to do another international charity called Living Water International. The development director for the West, Jeff Chase. Here's the interview with him.
So I'm here with the development director for the West, Jeff Chase of Living Water International. Jeff, thanks for joining me today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So can you give a little history about Living Water International and what your organization does for the community?
Yeah, so we're an international nonprofit, and we've been around for about 27 years. We were started in 1990.
Okay.
A group from Houston, Texas went over to Kenya. Actually, it was a group from church and some business leaders and some other people. And they saw the need when they were over there. They saw the need for clean water. They saw women and children, you know, walking miles and coming back with, you know, just basically dirty, muddy water that they couldn't even see through.
Okay.
And they were actually there partly for a medical mission and realized that, you know, if they don't solve the underlying problem, you know, they're just treating the symptoms. And so that's kind of how the organization got started. And so since then, we've done about 19,000 water projects all over the world. And, you know, really our goal is just to serve communities that lack access to safe water, bring them that resource, help them understand clean sanitation hygiene practices, and really make it sustainable so that they can take care of themselves going forward.
Okay. And when you talk about the water projects you've done, what kind of projects are they? Are they more about like sanitation projects or drinking water? How does that work?
So it is, the focus is bringing in, you know, safe and accessible drinking water.
Okay.
That's where everything starts with, you know, transformation in the communities. And that looks a variety. So the main thing that we've done, we started out basically drilling wells from Houston. They knew how to drill wells.
That makes sense.
A lot of people from the oil and gas industry.
Yeah.
But so a lot of them are simple hand pumps. So we'll drill a borehole, put a hand pump on there that doesn't require electricity or generators or anything like that. And that's the main thing that we've done over years. But we also will work with a community that whatever's the best solution for that community. So we will put in electric submersible pumps if they have a power source. We've done rain catchment. We do protected springs that are like larger systems that will then get piped down to actual like faucet taps in households or in the community. So we do a variety of things. I would say boreholes are still the number one solution that we use. But
okay. But
again, we do many things if it's more appropriate for that community.
Okay. And you're called Living Water International. So where internationally are you guys focused on?
Well, currently we are working in 17 countries. We've been in some countries and. The main focus right now is what we want to do is in the communities that we're in, we want to go deeper in each of those communities. So our main focus areas are Central America, Haiti, Peru, and we do some in southern Mexico.
Okay.
We work throughout India, mm-hmm. and then we're in sub-Saharan Africa. So we're in about 7-8 countries in Africa as well.
Okay. So can you talk about the effects waterborne illnesses have on a population who doesn't have access to safe drinking water?
Yeah, I mean, it's devastating. You know, there's a lot of statistics of, you know, how many kids don't make it to the age of 5. I mean, we have stories about communities that don't even name their kids for the first year or two.
Wow.
Just because the infant mortality rate is so high. And so, you know, you go on up and dirty water and the diseases that it carries affects the entire population. And so, you know, you have communities that are just stuck in this cycle of extreme poverty because they're using all their time and resources, you know, to try and stay healthy or battling these illnesses and, you know, high mortality rates. And so, you know, it really affects all aspects of life in a community. And so what we consider water to be the first step in just the development of that community, because water, once you have clean, safe water, and, you know, the other thing is it's not just bringing the clean water into communities, it's teaching and training them to understand germ transmission and some of these other things, because they need to be able to keep the water safe from collection to consumption.
Okay.
Because if they're using dirty utensils, they're not washing their hands, they're not using latrines, that type of thing, you know, you basically negate the benefit of the safe water that you're pumping for them. So
yeah, you're just contaminating the water that had become safe.
Exactly. And so, you know, what we really see is when you bring clean water into a community, they understand how to keep it safe and use it properly. It really does. It transforms all aspects of life because it affects, you know, they can have clean health practices, good sanitation. Basically, kids aren't getting sick and staying out of school. So kids are staying in school either because they're not sick, or, you know, women and children are the main resource to have to go collect water, usually walking far distances for unsafe water. And so,
yeah.
You know, all those hours spent, you know, I think the studies by like World Health Organization are around 200 million hours are spent every single day around the world with women and children basically walking for unsafe water. And so
that's,
you
know, insane.
You look at when they get all that time back, women can take care of their families, they can start small businesses, kids get to stay in school. You know, that is how communities get transformed economically and physically. So, you know, that's the goal. So when you can bring that in, you know, when it can solve a lot of the health issues, it really does open up that community for so many more things.
So clean water and safe sanitation, safe hygiene practices, they can really impact people just beyond having clean drinking water. It'd go into education and then, like, growth of a community.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We, you know, we've gone back to communities that have, you know, had a well or a new water, clean water source where we've worked. We've gone back, you know, even within a year, you see drastic changes. We've gone back and gone to health clinics in those communities where, you know, they'll have a chart on the wall of instances of, like, cholera and typhoid, and it's just this steady number, and then suddenly the chart almost goes to zero, and you say, you know, what was the reason behind that? And they're like, that's when the well came into the community.
Oh.
You know, and so, yeah, it is truly transformational, and it's just such a basic necessity, a basic resource for life.
So in the areas that you're working, are they mostly rural or are they larger communities?
We typically work in rural, so it's outside normal infrastructure. Our model now is, and you know, it used to be that, and there's a lot of orgs that are doing great work now, and I think as a sector, as a water sector, it's gotten a lot better in the last several years with people trying to realize that, it, you know, it's not only just bringing a well or a water source into a community, but, you know, that it needs to be sustainable. The community needs to take ownership of that project. They need to know the safe practices. They need to know how to maintain and repair the water source, you know, because for years, orgs were going in and drilling wells and then leaving to go to the next community.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a mechanical device, and you know it can break from overuse. It can break from parts wear out.
Sure.
You know, you'll have animals go up to scratch themselves on the handle and break it off. And so, you know, these wells were installed, and then anywhere from, you know, sometimes as little as 4 months later or years later, they stopped working and were abandoned. And so we also work in communities to help restore. We rehabilitate broken wells that were installed by government and other orgs.
Okay.
But anyway, but yeah, we work rurally because a lot of times there's not support out there. There's just not even the infrastructure in some of these developing countries. You know, the resources of the government that are usually lacking stay in the high populous areas. And so our model, we call them, you know, in this world, you hear the term WASH, which stands for Water Access, Sanitation, and Hygiene.
Okay.
We install what we call, we work in WASH program areas. So we'll go into a country, oftentimes we'll work with the Ministry of Health, other orgs to determine sectors of the country that have extreme need. And so we'll go into basically districts that are usually between about 35 to 100,000 people, but those are spread out over multiple communities and villages. And our goal as Living Water is to go in there, work in that sector for a 3 to 5, 6 year period. And our goal is by the time we leave that at least, you know, 85% of households in that entire district have access to safe water, have been taught safe sanitation, hygiene practices, et cetera. So we feel our biggest impact is in some of these rural communities.
Okay. And then as someone who's doing this work on a day-to-day basis, what kind of, what do you think about how clean water is? I mean, do you think that people are having better access, more access to having safe drinking water and sanitation, or do you think that it's getting worse?
Good question. Well, you know, I would say we're making strides. So, you know, if you look back to statistics that were about 8, 9, 10 years ago, you know, the statistics showed that at that point, about 1.2 billion people on the planet lacked access to safe water.
Okay.
Actually, the statistic was lacked access to an improved water source.
That doesn't mean safe.
And the Millennium Development Goals through the UN. But, you know, since then, if you look at the statistics now, you'll see statistics now at about 663, 664 million. So if you think, well, man, in the last 10 years, we have cut in half the number of people that lack access to an improved water source. So we are, you know, that's great. That's a lot of people that have now have a better water source than did 10 years ago. And so when you look at those statistics, yes, there's great strides that have been made through a combination of private sector and government working on the problem.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see some statistics now that there's new goals called Sustainable Development Goals, and they changed how they define what is safe water, because, and not to get too geeky on you here, but an improved water source could be a shallow hand-dug well. And so, but we know from our work that shallow hand-dug well still gets surface contaminants.
Sure, sure.
And also, a lot of times, we'll go dry in some of these countries. We'll go dry during the dry season for four or five months plus.
Okay.
So that's not really a good water source if it's still contaminated and still goes dry and you lose that source. And so the goals have changed where they're actually describing it now much more succinctly in that you want someone to have access to a reliable source, and basically it needs to be within a 30-minute round trip. You have to be able to walk and mm-hmm. wait in line, possibly if there's people queuing up for water, and get back to your household within 30 minutes. And so when you look at that, you're going to see numbers that look like a lot less people have access to that, like back up into the 1 or more billion people.
Okay.
But I think it's a more accurate play. And it actually shows the true value of water and that it's sustainable and year-round and people aren't wasting time going to get it. But all that to say is there's great strides. And, you know, for every dollar invested, you know, it's estimated it returns about a $4 benefit to that community.
Okay.
And so, you know, as people have invested, you know, every dollar, $5, $10 here and there, it makes a difference, and we are making huge strides to try and bring safe water to everyone on the planet.
Yeah. And you mentioned the Millennium Development Goals and the Sustainable Development Goals. Do you think that those goals are achievable, or do you think that they are going to be doing enough?
I think they're achievable. There's way smarter people than me that argue it back and forth. But if you look at the Millennium Development Goals, which those went through 2015,
mm-hmm.
you know, one of the pieces, there were eight original focus areas, and it was everything from poverty and hunger to universal education.
Okay.
And then water was one of the subsects of an environmental sustainability goal. And, you know, the original goal was to basically drop by half, by 50%, the people that lacked access.
Okay.
And according to the how they measured it at the time, by 2015, actually, that goal was met. So the number of people getting measured, that number dropped by half of who still lacked access. So that was great.
Okay.
The toughie on that was the sanitation piece. So getting people to stop open defecation practices, start using latrines, start mm-hmm. using hand washing stations. That was a much tougher goal to hit. And so in that piece of it, the sanitation piece fell short a little bit. And so the next sustainable goals go through 2030.
Okay.
They're aggressive, but they went from basically 8 focus areas to 17 focus areas. And within that focus areas on the sustainable goals, there's like 169 targets. So they narrowed down how they measure, what they measure, to have more attainable goals, and so everyone knows what they're going for. So
yeah.
I know that's a very long answer, but I do think that they're attainable. I think there's a lot of good work being done out there.
Right on. And like sanitation practices themselves, I'm sure like you can go to different regions of the world and see how people take care of themselves when it comes to sanitation. But do you find that in different regions there are practices that people have had and held that are hard for them to let go and to like learn something new?
Yeah, I think getting people that you're absolutely right. There's all the whole range of what people do. But I would say that, you know, when you don't have running water or access to safe water, when you don't have that source, you know, many people, especially in these rural areas, they sometimes do realize that they need a latrine or a pit toilet.
Okay.
But then they don't understand, like, everything that goes with germ transmission. So what they'll do is, you know, we've seen it where, yes, it's great that they have a pit latrine,
mm-hmm.
but the pit latrine is located about 20 feet to the side of their hand-dug well.
Oh.
And so, you know, you're thinking, well, everything that's going in the pit latrine is almost at the same level in
the
dirt as the bottom of the well. And, you know, all those germs are migrating, you know, in the groundwater
yeah.
over to the drinking water. So, you know, it's teaching them safe distances, you know, putting latrines, you know, if possible, downhill from a well and a certain distance away. But a lot of the world is still, you know, they just go out and go to the bathroom just wherever. They'll go out and, you know, in the bush or behind a
sure.
tree or behind their house or whatever. And
mm-hmm.
so the main culprit in a lot of the problems is what, you know, is open defecation. So it's
okay.
really getting people to understand that that's not safe, but it's also just, you know, cultural norms within that community that's how it's always been done. And so you're overcoming, you know, years and years and years of training and culture to try and do this. But we see, we work with communities, we try and train them, we try and help them self-discover why this may not be a good practice.
Okay.
And we see really good results. I mean, you know, a couple years ago in West Africa was the big Ebola outbreak.
Yeah.
And one of the countries we work in over there is Liberia. Liberia, Sierra Leone, those were kind of ground zero for a lot of the Ebola stuff.
Yeah.
And there were some communities that we'd worked with. There was five specific communities that we'd worked with that actually got certified by Living Water and by the Liberian government as ODF, which is open defecation free.
Okay.
And so they built latrines. The population wasn't going out anymore doing that. They had hand washing stations.
Uh-huh.
And throughout the entire Ebola crisis, at the end of it, those five communities that had been open defecation free did not have a single case of Ebola in their communities.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, you start highlighting things like that in surrounding communities, and they realize that, you know, that they do need to change their practices, and
sure,
it's for their benefit.
So, of course, we hear mostly about water scarcity being a major issue in countries that are not the United States. We don't hear too much about, like, lack of drinking water or lack of water other than California. You kind of hear that every now and then, California is running out of water. What do you think that somebody in Washington State could do to help with any kind of water scarcity issues?
Well, I think the big thing is awareness. And there, you know, there is water scarcity in some places in the United States.
Yeah.
I know, you know, there are some Native American reservations and,
uh-huh,
and some other areas, rural, in the United States that lack, you know, a safe water source or have some water scarcity.
Sure.
But we also feel that, you know, there are resources here. But for like the state of Washington, you know, when you're, I think we just have to realize the big thing is awareness and realizing that, you know, we do have it pretty good here. And
yeah,
I know we joke around in the Pacific Northwest, like, you know, like we have too much water, you know, 7 months
it comes
out
from
of
the
year,
sky, yeah,
complaining about the rain. And
yeah.
But we do have a pretty good source, and we still are called to be good stewards of that. And,
okay,
you know, what we do here not only affects us locally, but I do believe it affects global weather and global patterns that contribute to things, you know, in Africa or India.
Sure.
But, you know, I think the biggest thing what people can do here is be aware of their own practices. Personally, take steps to reduce water use from, you know, for yourself.
Okay.
But then, you know, how now that you're aware and now you understand that need, you know, how can I help and affect someone else somewhere else?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, just spreading the news about the global water crisis, spreading awareness to others, and then, you know, obviously maybe contributing some resources. I know, you know, there's all sorts of different things that you can measure, but, you know, on average it takes about $5 per person, or, you know, $5 to supply one person with clean water for a year. And so that takes in a lot of factors, but it's an easy thing to put your mind around.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we like to say, and a lot of these communities are, you know, families of, you know, 4, 5, 6 people, but, you know, somewhere between, you know, $20 to $30 a month, you know, you can provide safe water for an entire family and really change their lives drastically. So I would say, you know, for someone locally in Washington, it's making personal choices, one, to make yourself more aware and to understand the problem, spread the word to others in their circle of influence about what they're doing and what they see, and then maybe contributing to help supply this resource for someone across the globe that, you know, has no way to do that on their own.
Very nice. So let's say someone hears this podcast and they want to begin giving to Living Water International. Can you talk a little bit about what donations do for your organization?
Yeah, well, you know, being a nonprofit, we survive solely on donations and
mm-hmm.
grants. And so, you know, the money comes in and we put that out to go work in communities. So when general donations come in, Those go into a where most needed fund that help us fund projects around the world that are not funded by specific donors.
Okay.
You know, we also have donors that really have a heart for the work and maybe have a little bit more resource-wise, you know, with money and can donate a larger amount. And people, you know, we have people that also will sponsor a direct and specific project. So, you know, someone can get a hold of me and decide that, you know, hey, I want a fund, a well for an entire community in India or okay. in Kenya or in Nicaragua. And, you know, they will actually get direct reporting back with GPS coordinates and community information and before and after pictures.
That's cool.
With that. But, you know, even monthly giving will get reports back where some of the examples of communities that their donation has gone to help. And so mm-hmm. we really, our goal is that when someone makes a donation, to try and show direct impact from that donation as much as possible.
Very nice. And then since it's World Water Month, I'm sure you guys have any events, but do you have any upcoming events or programs you want to highlight?
You know, we constantly have things, you know, for us, the big one coming up is our annual gala, which that's in Houston. So that, you know, but we do have people travel to that, but it's a big
sure.
celebration. But, you know, ongoing, it's, you know, we consider every month World Water Month.
It makes
in
sense.
Our org, not to diminish the power of World Water Month or World Water Day.
Sure.
Because those are absolutely needed to raise awareness. But,
yeah.
you know, we're working year round in these countries. In 2017, we did about 1,300 water projects. And so, you know, there's things going on every single day, every single week. And so, you know, really what we have highlighted would be to check us out, check our website at water.cc. And, you know, there's a lot of resources there. People basically, you know, what we would say is we would rather, you know, Washingtonians get personally involved in the water crisis. We love to partner with people, but we love to empower people to
sure.
really get on board and do things themselves. And so, you know, there's monthly giving program. There is, you know, we have things called Team Living Water where people run races, climb, you know, I've had a group climb Mount Rainier a couple years
oh,
now
wow.
to raise money for water projects.
Nice.
We've had people, you know, do Seattle to Portland bike ride to
yeah.
raise money for living water and raise awareness. And so really what we say is like, you know, whatever you're doing, whatever you love to do, figure out a way to involve raising awareness and maybe raising some funding towards those projects. And that's fantastic.
Right on. Well, Jeff, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Well, it's my pleasure, and thank you so much for having us and just making people aware of the work that's going on.
Right on.
Okay, so that was our interview with Jeff Chase and Living Water International, both two very cool organizations that are doing some pretty awesome things in developing countries around
yes.
the world. Why don't you hit us with a little bit of some of the facts and figures associated with water and water issues?
Absolutely. So water issues, water scarcity is a big one because
okay.
if you don't have access to water,
yeah.
that's considered scarcity.
Yeah.
So it is apparently affecting every continent.
Oh.
I don't know about Antarctica.
That's good news.
Yeah, I know, right? I don't know how Antarctica is like affected by water
right,
scarcity.
Right.
I imagine like... Okay, sure.
Okay.
I mean,
you are a box of ice.
Yeah, and there aren't a ton of people who are there drinking
sure.
water, probably. But in 2015, the World Economic Forum listed this water scarcity as the largest global risk.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I think of it, too.
Yeah. And nearly 700,000 people in Asia and the Pacific lack safe drinking water.
Wow.
They're surrounded by water and
yeah.
oceans and things, but,
yeah.
yeah, there's no way to drink all that
yeah.
water. And, of course, the poorest countries who have the least available as far as technology go are the ones who use the most water for agriculture.
Right.
Because their agricultural technology hasn't caught up to
yes, right.
the rest of the modern world.
Yeah.
And that's where they spend a lot of their water.
Yeah.
And then I found this thing that UK scientists have created a sieve capable of making seawater drinkable.
Uh-huh.
But...
I was just about to ask that question.
Yeah. It is something that is kind of, you know, still out there and not... like worldwide and going.
It is interesting to me that we have invented so many different things.
Yeah.
The ability for you to be picked up using an app on your phone.
Yeah, by a stranger, get by a stranger's car.
A weird stranger picking you up. Yeah, that's a strange one. We invented supercomputers and the cloud and all these sort of different things.
There's nanotechnologies.
Yeah. How is it that we have not been able to master taking salt out of ocean water?
Also, considering that with climate change,
yeah,
water levels are rising.
Yeah.
So we're going to have to get rid of some of that water.
You could totally use that extra water.
Let's drink it. Let's drink it.
That'll solve it.
I like it. So the UK scientists are hoping that making seawater drinkable will definitely help millions of people who don't have access within five years.
Amazing. That'd be so cool.
And then I pulled some interesting data. 5 countries most threatened by water shortages. Would you like to guess any of them?
Yeah, so I'm going to say a few of them have got to be in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa. I'm going to say something like, well, South Africa, because Cape Town, right?
You know, that's not on this list.
Holy cow, they ran out of water. Cape Town ran out of water. How's that not on this list?
Yeah, so apparently not on this list.
All right, whatever.
Yeah.
All right, how about, I'm going to say, let's call it South Sudan, Rwanda area.
The closest ones in the area they've got on this list are Libya and Djibouti.
Oh, wow.
Libya is number one. Djibouti is number four.
Aww.
Yeah. Hey, what's the capital of Djibouti?
Djibouti.
Boom. I love it.
Yeah. Okay.
And then there's another location in Africa, which is not technically a country still, but it's the disputed territory of Western Sahara. So it's in the western northwest of Africa.
Okay.
So they are having... they have refugees there, and they have constant food and water shortages.
Right.
And then there are 2 countries in the Middle East.
Oh. Okay. Iraq?
Nope.
No.
Not on this list.
How about Syria?
No, not on this list. I mean, you'd expect Syria to have
Syria
something like
Iraq,
that because war-torn of war.
War-torn countries, yeah.
But yeah, this, like, one of them is definitely war-torn now.
Really?
Conflict, yeah.
Like Yemen?
Yemen.
Wow, Yemen!
Yemen's number 3.
Wow.
So yeah, it's definitely that kind of, like, they don't have a lot of natural fresh water.
Right.
So they have to rely on other sources and things like imports. And when
makes sense.
War-torn,
you're not
so
getting
much.
As much of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You got an idea for the last one?
It's also Middle East?
Yeah.
Is it small?
Smaller than Iran, Iraq, yeah.
Okay.
Bigger than Yemen.
Jordan?
Yeah.
Jordan!
Nice job.
Thank you.
Yeah, number 5. So,
wow.
Yeah, they right now, they rely on their own natural resources, so mostly it's the Dead Sea and the Jordan River, and they are dropping in
water levels. And that's because, in part, they're getting a ton of refugees from, like, Syria.
They are. So, yeah, they've got an influx of people, which definitely means they need more water.
This is another one of those environmental issues. You and I have talked about this multiple times.
Yeah.
Where I feel like, you know, the global warming thing has become incredibly politicized.
Yeah.
This is one of those issues that I believe, just like with pollution and, and, you know, plastics and things like that, is so apolitical.
Yeah.
That I think you could even get the sides that, like, maybe for whatever reason are still skeptical of climate change.
Yeah.
You could get somebody on board with this.
Oh,
this
absolutely.
This is tangible.
This is tangible.
Like, affected people.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think that this is another one of those moments where I think if you're a Republican, if you're Democrat, if you're conservative, if you're liberal, things are like what happened in Flint, Michigan.
Yeah.
They enraged everybody.
Oh yeah!
It wasn't just one particular party or one particular ideology that was upset by that. Everybody was. So I think that this has the potential, if we do it right, to unite a lot of people in a pretty good way.
Yeah, and we did talk in both the interview with Jeff and David. We talked a little bit about the United Nations Foundation. They have sustainable development goals that were in place, and number 6 is clean water and sanitation.
Mm.
So I'll post this on the podcast so people can see what all 17 goals are.
Yeah.
But like both like I think Jeff is a little more hopeful than David is about it, but like
really?
It is something where what their standards are, they don't have to actually go beyond certain things. So if they say there needs to be clean pipes or pipes for water to get through, the pipes don't have to be up to a certain standard.
Got it.
So they could still be contaminating the water.
Yeah, that makes sense, right? Yeah. I mean that's one thing for all the sort of weird things that we have going on in this country, we have done a great job making sure when we first put all these things in that they were constructed in a certain way. Our challenge from here on out, of course, is that we have to now maintain that stuff.
Yes.
Which is the boring stuff. The building it new is always the exciting part. The maintaining the stuff that's already built is always the stuff that's the tougher sell.
Exactly.
And so if we're not careful, we're going to get in that. We're going to get in that realm too.
Oh yeah.
Where cities have dirty water because their pipes are rusting. Remember?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. It's a big deal, people.
It is a big deal.
It's a big deal.
Big deal.
Big deal. So it was awesome for you to talk to those people.
Next one, I promise.
All right, great. Thank you. Set it up again.
You're welcome.
And Matt Damon, come on the show.
Okay.
You're totally welcome to come on the show. I got a feeling you and I are going to be friends.
Matt Damon, we could get Michael Jordan, too. I mean, I'm sure he's got something to do with water.
I'm sure Michael's got some opinions on the subject.
Yeah, right?
I mean, maybe that'll be a dual show.
Gatorade. You need water to drink Gatorade.
Yes.
And create Gatorade.
You do. Yeah. There you go. Michael, come on the show. Come on the show. Water is the Michael Jordan of issues.
Boom. Drop that mic. There we go.
Yeah. So trying every time.
Yep.
So we'll hit you with some upcoming events. Right now we're actually having folks able to come to the site if you're a volunteer, order your supplies. Mm-hmm. We're shipping them as we speak. We're also going through multiple trainings.
Yes.
We'll have one in King on August 15th. We'll have one in Spokane on August 17th and one in Vancouver on August 23rd. So if you haven't signed up for one of those, please do so. We are also, as we're in these areas, going around to different charities, filming them, asking about what they do and their missions. So we'll have those for our Friday Flick segments during the campaign. And then, of course, tomorrow is the Employment Security Department softball tournament.
Yes.
Benefiting multiple charities. Each team is playing for an individual charity. Yeah. So if you have an opportunity and you're in the Auburn area, specifically near Brennan Park, I mean, it's right off the highway.
Yeah, it is.
if you go ahead and do that, you can swing by and check out softball tournament being played by multiple agencies. So a whole bunch of stuff. We're kind of in it now.
Oh yeah.
We're during campaign time, ramping up. As a reminder, there will be if you like these sort of podcasts, we will have a podcast every single day during the campaign, every single work day.
No, we don't.
Every single work day.
We need to take a little bit of a break.
Yeah. Don't bother us on the weekends.
Yeah.
We're doing things.
Yeah, we're in Silverwood. Leave us alone.
Yeah. That's right. So it's part of what we call the daily drip segment. So how that'll work is on days where there's not one of these bigger, longer, you know, more robust podcasts, we'll have short 10-minute segments on different charities highlighting them. So we encourage you to stay tuned in the iTunes account, or you can visit the website anytime you want.
Yeah.
And this has been Episode 5 of Season 2, World Water Month. Big congratulations to Heather for being able to interview people that I wanted to interview. Congratulations.
Thank you. I will prepare my speech and post it on the podcast as well.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, folks. We'll talk to you next time.
Bye.